Kim Purcell is an award-winning real estate sales representative working under the Sutton Group Masters Realty Brokerage. Kim was born and raised in Kingston and is into her ninth year of real estate. She has intimate knowledge of the area, which has positively influenced her career as a realtor and led to numerous five-star reviews from clients. If you're looking for a real estate agent in the Kingston area who is trustworthy and will work for your best interests, you're in good hands with Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca to learn more about Kim's realty services and listings today.
Broadcasting 24/7, 365, you're listening to 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca, Kingston's only campus community radio station. Tune in for the best local programming.
Is Democracy Now!
We should all be concerned about the attacks on our First Amendment and lawsuits like this that really threaten our rights to peaceful protest and free speech.
A jury in North Dakota has ordered Greenpeace to pay more than $660 million in damages to the company behind the Dakota Access Pipeline over Greenpeace's role in the Indigenous-led protest at Standing Rock. We'll speak with environmental lawyer Steve Donziger, who monitored the trial. Then we go from attacks on the right to protest to attacks on press freedom.
These networks and these newspapers are really no different than a highly paid political operative. And it has to stop. It has to be illegal.
As President Trump accuses the press of engaging in illegal activity, we'll speak to New York Times editor David Enrich, author of the new book, Murder the Truth, Fear, the First Amendment, and a Secret Campaign to Protect the Powerful.
What's at stake isn't just press freedom, it's the freedom of anyone who has an opinion or wants to speak truth about powerful institutions and individuals to do so without the fear of being sued into oblivion if you get a fact or two wrong or make an honest mistake.
And we'll talk to an immigration attorney who's representing an LGBTQ Venezuelan asylum seeker now being jailed in El Salvador. She says her client was falsely accused of being a gang member, then flown out of the U.S. after Trump invoked the Alien Enemies Act of 1798. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's army has reinvaded the Gaza Strip, reclaiming control over the Netzarim corridor, which splits the besieged Palestinian territory in two. Israel's also continuing to bombard Gaza by land, air, and sea for a third straight day after Israel unilaterally shattered the Gaza ceasefire Tuesday. Gaza's health ministry says Israel's renewed attacks have killed 710 Palestinians, including at least 95 people, since daybreak today. One of those was a newborn baby. Another 900 Palestinians have been injured, a majority of them women and children. Some of the wounded died due to severe shortages of medical equipment from Israel's total blockade of Gaza, which took effect on March 2nd. On Wednesday, Israeli planes dropped leaflets over Beit Lahia and Beit Hanun in northern Gaza and parts of Khan Yunis in the south, ordering residents once again to leave their homes. The order affects thousands of people who'd previously been expelled multiple times by Israel's army.
We were feeling safe. We couldn't believe we had just started having stability in our lives, and suddenly the situation has been turned around under the threat of the Israeli aggression. They forced us to leave Beit Hanun. I swear to God, we don't have any shelter except in Beit Hanun. We had just started having some stability in the 40 days of ceasefire.
The United Nations has condemned the Israeli killing of one of its workers Wednesday. Five others were wounded, several severely, in the airstrike on a UN building in Deir al-Balah. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for a full investigation. UN official Jorge Moreira da Silva said the UN compound is located in a deconflicted zone, he said, well known by the Israeli Defense Forces.
In my opinion, this was not an accident. It cannot be categorized as an accident. It is at least an incident. What is happening in Gaza is unconscionable. I'm shocked and devastated by this tragic news.
A group of lawyers has launched a global coalition that'll seek to pursue legal action against Israeli dual nationals accused of being involved in war crimes in Gaza. The International Center of Justice for Palestinians said they'll use domestic and international law against Israeli soldiers and others, quote, spanning the entire Israeli military and political chain of command, unquote. Meanwhile, the U.S. is continuing its bombing of Yemen. On Wednesday, Trump vowed to annihilate the Houthi group after it announced it would resume strikes on commercial targets in the Red Sea following Israel's withdrawal from the Gaza ceasefire. Israel said it intercepted a missile launch from Yemen earlier today. Thousands of protesters across the U.S. and around the world are taking to the streets after Israel unilaterally pulled out of the Gaza ceasefire. This is a demonstrator who joined a rally in Tunisia's capital Wednesday.
We call on Arab people to take to the streets and bear their historical responsibilities because Palestine is the fortress of struggle and the fortress of steadfastness. And the Yemeni people are the last wall of resistance in the face of American aggression and in the face of Zionist aggression.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said Wednesday he's ready to pause attacks on Russian fuel depots and energy infrastructure following a phone call with President Trump. His pledge came a day after Russian President Vladimir Putin similarly agreed to halt attacks on Ukrainian energy sites during a call with Trump. However, Putin rejected a proposed 30-day ceasefire and insisted any deal should include an end to military aid and intelligence sharing with Ukraine. During Wednesday's call with Zelensky, Trump reportedly proposed the U.S. could take ownership of Ukraine's nuclear power stations like the Russian-occupied Zaporizhzhia plant, the largest nuclear power plant in Europe. Meanwhile, Russia and Ukraine each exchanged 175 prisoners of war Wednesday in one of the largest prisoner swaps since Russia invaded Ukraine over 3 years ago. Some of the POWs have been held in Russian jails since the start of the war.
Where haven't I been imprisoned? I've been in Luhansk, then I was sent to Bashkiristan, very far away. It was the hardest there. We were tortured there very hard. Boys didn't make it there. Some even lost their minds.
A new report from the UN's Independent International Commission of Inquiry on Ukraine finds Russia's committed widespread and systematic attacks on Ukraine's civilian population, including enforced disappearances and torture that constitute crimes against humanity. In North Dakota, a jury ruled against Greenpeace Wednesday, ordering the environmental group to pay $667 million in damages in a defamation case brought by Energy Transfer. The pipeline company claimed Greenpeace organized the historic Standing Rock protests in 2016 and 17, which were led by indigenous water and land defenders. Lawyers for Greenpeace are appealing the ruling. This is Deepa Padmanabha.
I'm not surprised. I mean, when you look at the original complaint and this revisionist history of how Standing Rock came about and Greenpeace's role, this is another revisionist history of what this case was about and what the outcome symbolizes. This is an attack on the First Amendment. This is a very blatant attack.
We'll speak with environmental lawyer Steve Donziger after headlines. President Trump's expected to sign an executive order today to begin dismantling the Education Department, according to reports. The department cannot be formally shut down without congressional approval, but Trump's order would further slash its workforce, restrict its authority, redistribute some of its key functions, and hand over more decision-making authority to states and local school districts. The Trump administration's already cut the Education Department's workforce roughly in half. In other education news, the American Federation Federation of Teachers is suing Trump's Department of Education for shutting down income-driven student loan repayment plans used by millions of borrowers. The union accused the Trump administration of effectively freezing the nation's student loan system. Separately, two parents and a national disability rights group last week filed a lawsuit accusing Trump and Education Department head Linda McMahon of sabotaging civil rights enforcement in education by firing the agency's investigators and lawyers who handle discrimination complaints at schools. Meanwhile, the Justice Department has removed a number of guidelines explaining how businesses can comply with the landmark Americans with Disabilities Act. The ADA.gov website had pages removed explaining accessibility requirements for shops as well as guidance on mask wearing to protect against COVID. Federal immigration agents detained a Georgetown University postdoctoral researcher in peace and conflict studies this week, told him his visa was revoked, and are trying to deport him. Badar Khan Suri is an Indian national on a student visa. Suri's wife is Mafez Saleh, a U.S. citizen from Palestine and a Georgetown student who in recent weeks came under online attacks by pro-Zionist websites. She's the daughter of a former political advisor to the Hamas government. Suri's lawyer says the pair is being targeted because they've spoken out for Palestinian rights. The University of Pennsylvania is the latest school to be targeted by the Trump administration, which announced it's suspending $175 million in federal funding to the Ivy League University as a penalty for allowing transgender athletes to compete in women's sports. The UPenn news comes as Columbia is reportedly on the verge of acquiescing to Trump's 9 demands issued in order for his administration to restore $400 million in funding. The demands include banning face masks, ramping up Colombia's law enforcement authority, and placing the Middle Eastern, South Asian, and African Studies Department under academic receivership or external oversight. Trump set a deadline of today for Columbia University to respond. Princeton University President Chris Eisgruber is calling on, quote, universities and their leaders to speak up and litigate forcibly to protect their rights, unquote. In a piece for The Atlantic, he calls Trump's attack on Columbia the greatest threat to American universities since the Red Scare of the 1950s. Eisgruber added, quote, robust federal funding helped make American universities the world's best, but it also created a huge risk, unquote. Meanwhile, the University of California said Wednesday it'll stop requiring diversity statements in its hiring and imposed a system-wide hiring freeze amidst threats by President Trump to withhold federal funds. In more news about Colombia, a judge has transferred Mahmoud Khalil's case to New Jersey, where it'll be overseen by President Biden-appointed Judge Michael Farbiage. U.S. District Judge Jesse Furman cleared the way for Khalil to stay in the United States and challenge his arrest and the Trump administration's attempts to deport him for protesting for Palestinian rights while he was a graduate student at Columbia. Khalil is a permanent U.S. resident. He had a green card. He was arrested in Manhattan but detained in New Jersey when his lawyers filed suit. He was subsequently transferred to an ICE jail where he is now in Jena, Louisiana. The Council on American Islamic Relations has launched a campaign calling on the University of New Hampshire and Harvard to withdraw their hirings of former President Biden's National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan and former White House Coordinator for the Middle East and North Africa Brett McGurk. Kerr said in a statement the two men, quote, spent 4 years acting as shadow presidents and executing foreign policy disaster after foreign policy disaster from the botched U.S. troop withdrawal from Afghanistan to President Biden's embrace of dictators he once pledged to ostracize to the horrific genocide in Gaza, unquote. A coalition of rights groups and community advocates in New Mexico has filed a civil rights complaint warning 48 people have been disappeared after a wave of immigration raids in Santa Fe, Roswell, and Albuquerque. This is Rebecca Sheff, attorney for the ACLU of New Mexico.
We know that enforced disappearance is unlawful under the U.S. Constitution. We know that disappearing people is also prohibited under international human rights law. We know that when a government apprehends somebody and conceals what's happened to them or their whereabouts, that's a human rights violation.
The coalition of groups is calling on New Mexico legislators to pass two bills to protect residents, HB 9, the Immigrant Safety Act, and SB 250, the No State and Local Resources for Immigration Enforcement Act. Pentagon Chief Pete Hegseth said he's appealing a ruling by a federal judge Tuesday which blocked the Trump administration's ban on transgender military members. U.S. District Judge Ana Reyes ruled the sweeping ban violates the Constitution's Equal Protection Clause and called it, quote, soaked in animus. And in more military news, the Pentagon's removed or earmarked for removal at least 24,000 articles from its website. They include historical content on military members of color, women, and military members from the LGBTQ community, as well as pages on Holocaust remembrance, cancer awareness, sexual assault, and suicide prevention. A page on groundbreaking African-American baseball player Jackie Robinson's military career had recently disappeared and then, with fierce protest, reappeared after public backlash. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The environmental group Greenpeace is vowing to appeal after a jury in North Dakota ordered the organization to pay $667 million in damages for defaming Energy Transfer Partners, the corporation behind the Dakota Access Pipeline. The Texas-based pipeline company accused Greenpeace of orchestrating criminal behavior by training and providing funds to the indigenous-led protest at Standing Rock nearly a decade ago. Greenpeace said it played a minor role at the protests and warned the lawsuit was aimed at destroying the right to peaceful protest. Greenpeace attorney Deepa Padmanabha spoke outside the North Dakota courthouse on Wednesday.
What we saw these last 3 weeks was Energy Transfer's blatant disregard for the voices of the Standing Rock Sioux tribe. And while they also tried to rewrite Greenpeace's story, what this trial showed was Greenpeace's unwavering commitment to nonviolence in every action that we take. We should all be concerned about the attacks on our First Amendment and lawsuits like this that really threaten our rights to peaceful protest and free speech. And Greenpeace is going to continue its fight to protect these fundamental rights for everyone.
The indigenous water protector, Candy Mossett White, who took part in the Standing Rock protests, also spoke outside the courthouse in Mandan.
My name is Candy Mossett White. I'm born and raised in North Dakota. I'm originally from Newtown. I live in Bismarck. I'm Mandan, Hidatsa, Rikara, all along the lands down south. That is our historic lands that were destroyed. And this company got money for defamation for Greenpeace or for other people allegedly saying that they destroyed sacred sites. They did. I was there. They got the letter from the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer on Friday, September 2nd. And on September 3rd, their company moved all of their bulldozers up 2 weeks ahead of schedule and razed the entire area. There was burial grounds out there. And they're calling that defamation. It's true. That's what happened. I just don't understand how they can get away with it other than North Dakota is a huge fossil fuel state. I know that. I'm from here, is born and raised here.
Energy Transfer Partners attorney Trey Cox praised the jury's decision and accused Greenpeace of running a propaganda machine.
Greenpeace paid protesters and trained individuals to unlawfully disrupt the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline. Greenpeace maliciously misrepresented events within this community in an unrelenting attempt to stop, by any means possible, the construction of a pipeline that had already obtained all of the necessary legal approvals. These are the facts, not the fake news of the Greenpeace propaganda machine.
We're joined right now by Steve Donziger, who is part of the independent trial monitoring team that's been observing the Greenpeace trial in Dakota. Steve Donziger has his own history of battling corporations. He was targeted for prosecution by Chevron after he successfully sued the oil giant on behalf of 30,000 Amazonian indigenous people in Ecuador, whose land was devastated by oil spills. He ended up being disbarred and spending over 900 days under house arrest. Steve Donziger, welcome back to Democracy Now!, this time in studio. Start off, you were just in Mandan, you were just in North Dakota. Talk about the significance of this multi-hundred-million-dollar verdict against Greenpeace that could bankrupt them.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing, first of all, we were in court every day for 3 weeks. We had 8 or 9 attorneys on this team. We organized it because for months we've had concerns about this trial. It was very clear that this was not going to be a trial as that term is commonly understood. I would really call it more a choreographed show in a county that, you know, 75% of the people voted for Donald Trump. Greenpeace did a survey of residents prior to trial. 97% said they could not judge this case fairly. Of the jurors, most had ties to the fossil fuel industry. In our opinion, it was impossible for Greenpeace to get a fair trial in this county. And
why couldn't they get it moved?
Well, they tried repeatedly to get it moved, and the judge wouldn't move it. So that raises really another issue, which is the court itself, the judge in this case, just didn't seem to want to give Greenpeace anything. He repeatedly ruled against Greenpeace. The proceedings at the request of the company were held pretty much in secret. Trials in North Dakota are generally live streamed. Court TV had broadcast trials, but he cut off the live stream for the public and the media. It was very hard to get. The only way you could cover the trial was to actually be physically in court in this very isolated courthouse. So there was an effort, I think, really to shroud the trial in secrecy. Thousands of documents were sealed. So, you know, I don't think Greenpeace, just watching this as someone who's actually been through this, I don't think they stood a chance. What's interesting is, and sort of the larger issue, as Deepa pointed out, is this really is an attack on the First Amendment. I mean, Greenpeace really, in essence, was a stand-in, in my opinion, for the Standing Rock Sioux, for the climate movement, for the right to protest. And I think this company, and it's really been driven largely by CEO Kelsey Warren, who is a huge Trump supporter, is trying to use this as a vehicle really to intimidate the climate movement, intimidate the Standing Rock Sioux, and I think really chill for people's First Amendment rights. And as we know, in this environment right now in the United States, that's a serious, serious issue. So this trial has serious implications. It goes way beyond the environmental movement. It goes really to the right to protest. It affects church groups or religious organizations, political organizations, and I think people need to keep a close eye on it and really do what they can to protect Greenpeace.
How was a Texas-based company, Energy Transfer Partners, able to bring this case in North Dakota?
Well, the reason they brought it North Dakota is because the protest took place in North Dakota. So this pipeline runs from North Dakota down to Illinois. It's about 1,200 miles. And there were protests all along the way, but the most intense protest took place just south of, you know, Morton County, or in Morton County, where the trial was held. And they brought it there for the obvious reason to me that they felt like it was the most hospitable venue they could find. And, you know, again, it really was not a trial as is commonly understood. Like, they felt like they could get people on that jury who were completely sympathetic to the fossil fuel industry, and that's exactly what happened.
So explain what a slap lawsuit is, and as you talk about this being much more significant than this particular case.
So a slap lawsuit, and that's what I believe this is a lawsuit that's brought by a corporation or the government to silence people, someone who is speaking out, someone who's taking on the abuse of the corporation. And it's really designed not to resolve a legitimate legal claim. It's designed to really harass and impose extremely burdensome litigation on someone who cannot afford it, so they shut up and stop talking. And I think this is a classic slap lawsuit. I mean, the difference is Greenpeace has resources to defend it, and I thought their lawyers did a very, very good job under almost impossible circumstances. But it really is not a legitimate lawsuit. It's a lawsuit that violates the First Amendment to the Constitution because it's designed to silence people's legitimate, constitutionally protected right to speak out. And that's what happened to me, too, with Chevron. And what's interesting for me personally, Amy, is that the same law firm that Chevron deployed against me that led to almost 3 years of detention in a criminal contempt of court case, where I never got a jury because of my work on behalf of the Ecuadorian communities, that same law firm, Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher, was hired by Energy Transfer to go after Greenpeace with the same legal theories. And as we sat in court, I mean, it just felt like the false narrative all over again. I mean, basically, up was down, down was up, and the judge sort of made evidentiary decisions that let the company really put in a false narrative that, for example, the protesters were violent when everybody who was down there knows it was the law enforcement agencies and the private security companies hired by Energy Transfer that were really committing violence against the protesters. So there was a lot of false narrative in the courtroom, and the jury being, I think, predisposed to believe the company, they bought it.
Could this shutter Greenpeace?
I don't think so. I think this is an important point. We need to take a deep breath here. Greenpeace has a right to appeal. I think the due process violations in this trial were so serious. I think Greenpeace's chances on appeal are very, very good. I do not think this is going to shutter Greenpeace. What I would say is to people out there who care about these issues, the climate movement, indigenous rights, and the right to protest, rally behind Greenpeace. It's very important that the courts in North Dakota understand this is being watched all over the world and that it has implications for our entire country. I think Greenpeace is going to win the appeal. And my hope is they'll come out much stronger because of this experience, even though it's painful right now. In the long run, they will come out stronger because of the experience and get even more support.
Well, Steve Donziger, I want to thank you for being with us. Human rights and environmental defender who monitored the Greenpeace trial in North Dakota. Coming up, murdering the truth, fear, the First Amendment, and a secret campaign to protect the powerful. We'll speak with David Enrich of the New York Times. Stay with us.
So I ran to the river. It was bleeding around to the sea. It was bleeding around to the sea. It was bleeding all on them day. So I ran to the river. It was falling around to the sea. It was falling around to the sea. It was falling.
Nina Simone. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now from attacks on the right to protest to attacks on press freedom. President Trump is escalating his criticism of the news media, claiming many outlets are engaged in illegal activity. This is part of what he said last week during a speech at the Great Hall of the Department of Justice.
I believe that CNN and MSDNC, who literally write 97.6% bad about me, are political arms of the Democrat Party. And in my opinion, they're really corrupt and they're illegal. What they do is illegal. These networks and these newspapers are really no different than a highly paid political operative.
And it has to stop. It has to be illegal. It's influencing judges. And it's really changing law. And it just cannot be legal. I don't believe it's legal.
President Trump's comments come amidst a right-wing push to overturn protections for the press to investigate public figures, a right guaranteed by the landmark 1964 Supreme Court decision, New York Times versus Sullivan. We're joined now by David Enrich. He's New York Times business investigations editor. His new book is titled Murder, the Truth, Fear, the First Amendment, and a Secret Campaign to Protect the Powerful. If you can start off, it's great to have you with us, David, by talking about what this Supreme Court decision, this landmark decision in the 1960s, Sullivan, was all about.
Well, it was brought on behalf of supporters of Martin Luther King, and it basically detailed this litany of abuses by Southern officials. The gist of it was completely true. Southern officials were trying to preserve white supremacy. Some of the facts were either wrong or exaggerated. And a powerful Southern official named L.B. Sullivan sued the New York Times and won at trial. And the goal, basically, of Sullivan and his pals was that by filing lawsuits that seized on tiny little inaccuracies, you could punish the media for covering the civil rights movement. And so this went up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled in a unanimous decision in 1964 that in order to preserve free speech and allow people to write and criticize and investigate powerful people and institutions, the media and the public needed breathing room so that if they got a fact wrong by mistake or made an honest error, they would not be sued into oblivion. And so that Supreme Court ruling has really set the stage for decades of investigative journalism and for normal people, non-journalists as well, to speak up and kind of reveal abuses and criticize people who hold positions of power, both at the national level or at a community level
as
well.
And what does this mean for the First Amendment?
I mean, it means that the First Amendment gives everyone the right to speak and to interrogate powerful people. And you do not need to worry about, there should not be a legal cloud hanging over your head when you criticize or investigate someone powerful. And you do not need to worry that an innocent mistake is going to bankrupt you because of litigation.
So let's go back to 2016. Donald Trump vowing to make it easier to sue news organizations.
I'm going to open up our libel laws so when they write purposely negative and horrible and false articles, we can sue them and win lots of money. We're going to open up those libel laws so that when the New York Times writes a hit piece, which is a total disgrace, or when the Washington Post, which is there for other reasons, writes a hit piece, we can sue them and win money.
So that was before Donald Trump became president the first time around. Talk about the significance of what he's saying and the overall campaign is in your subtitle, The Secret Campaign to Protect the Powerful.
Well, when Donald Trump made those remarks in 2016, it kind of acted as the firing of a starter's pistol in a race. And it sent a signal to the entire kind of conservative movement, and in particular, the conservative legal movement, that a race was on to try to dismantle some of the longstanding First Amendment protections for the media and for others. And you can trace very directly back to that speech that he gave in Fort Worth, Texas, in February of 2016, the arrival on the scene of this kind of small cottage industry of high-priced lawyers whose entire practices were devoted to suing and threatening news outlets. And the more successes they piled up, the more this strategy caught on, so that by the time, and within a couple of years, there was a real grassroots movement and funded and fueled by the likes of the Federalist Society, the Heritage Foundation, the Claremont Institute, to really weaponize defamation laws to make it much, much scarier, really, especially for small and independent news outlets and journalists to write about powerful people, not just the president of the United States, but in their local communities, a big company, maybe a powerful real estate developer, things like that. And this strategy has now worked its way all the way up to the Supreme Court, where there is increasing support for either doing away with New York Times versus Sullivan altogether, or at least chipping away at it around the edges.
So you're the business investigations editor at the New York Times. What led you to write this book?
Well, we were getting, and still do, get inundated with legal threats basically every time that we start writing about or investigating someone powerful. And it occurred to me, you know, the New York Times is in a pretty good position to handle that kind of threat. But it occurred to me a few years ago that, you know, the experience might be very different if you worked at a smaller outlet or if you were an independent journalist. And, you know, there's so many independent journalists right now, which I think is a really good thing for the media and a good thing for our democracy. But it's people with a Substack newsletter or a blog or a podcast who are uniquely vulnerable to these types of threats and these types of litigation because they are enormously expensive to defend against. And they're not always meant to, these challenges are not always meant to win in court. They're often meant to just subject people to this torturous, long-running, and extremely expensive legal process. And a lot of people make the economically rational decision, which is that in the face of those threats and in the face of that litigation, they're going to back down rather than fight, which is exactly what the people making those threats want you to do.
So talk about how Hulk Hogan, or as you point out, much more relevantly, Peter Thiel fit into this story.
Yeah, so Peter Thiel had a long-running grudge against—
And explain who he is.
Yeah, Peter Thiel is one of the most powerful people in Silicon Valley. He was an early supporter of Donald Trump, and he's very closely aligned with people like Elon Musk. And
co-founder of PayPal.
Co-founder of PayPal, yes, and one of the owners of Palantir as well. And he had a long-running grudge against the website Gawker, because Gawker was really pioneering a form of journalism that was very skeptical of Silicon Valley elites and was kind of puncturing some of the bubble surrounding them. And so he set out in the early 2010s to destroy Gawker. And he went searching. He hired a bunch of people. He put a bunch of money into this. And he eventually settled on a case involving Hulk Hogan. Gawker had published a snippet of a sex tape involving Hulk Hogan. And so Peter Thiel secretly financed and organized a multifaceted legal campaign using Hulk Hogan as a vehicle for retribution against Gawker. He won, Hulk Hogan won, Peter Thiel won, Gawker was destroyed, and this became a real blueprint for other billionaires and other powerful people to really attack the media. They saw that a well-funded, well-orchestrated secret legal campaign had the ability to absolutely destroy a well-established media outlet.
So Gawker was destroyed. Now talk about some of the Supreme Court justices' views, particularly begin with Clarence Thomas.
Well, Clarence Thomas, during his confirmation hearings in 1991, expressed real support for New York Times versus Sullivan. He then went through a period where he got some very negative media coverage, and his views seemed to shift. And so by 2019, Clarence Thomas became the first sitting Supreme Court justice to openly call for the overturning of New York Times versus Sullivan. His argument originally was grounded in the 45 words of the First Amendment, which do not mention libel or defamation, and therefore he argued that should not be protected under the First Amendment. Really, though, this was a part of a campaign by Thomas and his allies to really erode the powers of the media and the protections for the media and normal people to speak up when they saw abuses and to criticize people like him. And so he, now joined by Neil Gorsuch as well, have really embraced this call and are trying to recruit other justices, I think, and are calling for other people to file lawsuits that might make their way up to the Supreme Court that will challenge these longstanding precedents that protect, again, not just press freedoms, but the right of a person in a community to circulate a petition, for example, or make a comment on Facebook about their mayor, things like that. So this is not just about protecting journalists. It's really about protecting anyone who wants to stand up and have their voice heard on matters of public importance.
Where does Neil Gorsuch stand?
Gorsuch has joined Thomas in wanting to have this overturned. And his views really, and he views Sullivan as protecting all sorts of online defamatory speech. The arguments that he have made, and one of the things I do in this book, is really deconstruct those arguments. And it turns out a lot of them are premised on not just kind of faulty logic, but inaccurate data that he cited, that he got from a Law Review article that was filled with a lot of false assumptions and kind of misinterpreted data. And so he has actually had to correct his opinion calling for the overturning of New York Times versus Sullivan, but it is still being cited to this day by the conservative legal movement as one of the real kind of sources of information and authority that should be used to overturn it.
You begin your book, the prologue, a panicked phone call. You tell the story of Guy Larson. Tell us who Guy Larson is.
So Larson is an American journalist and author who wrote a book that became the basis for the movie War Dogs, with starring Jonah Hill. And the book basically tells the story of how these three stoners from Miami Beach become international arms traffickers. It's kind of a rollicking, really fascinating tale. Some of the action is set in Albania. And there's a bit part in the book played by the son of Albania's former prime minister, who is kind of an autocratic strongman. And the details in the book, as far as I've been able to determine, are completely accurate. But for argument's sake, the son of the strongman claims that he was kind of smeared in the book and that some of the facts were wrong. So he filed a lawsuit against Lawson in the U.S. court. And it's worked its way. It's been kind of years winding its way through the legal process. It got dismissed by multiple courts. But years later, it worked its way up to the Supreme Court, and it became one of the latest vehicles to try and challenge Sullivan. And it was seized on by people who had been inspired by Clarence Thomas, who had basically issued an open invitation to lawyers and, you know, prospective litigants, begging them to bring him a case that he could use to overturn Sullivan. It made its way up to the Supreme Court. They did not get enough votes to actually overturn Sullivan or even hear the case, but it became another vehicle for Clarence Thomas and Neil Gorsuch to really bring this issue much more to public light and to argue forcefully that Sullivan should be overturned. And those calls, while unsuccessful, they did not get the Supreme Court to change the legal standard. They inspired hordes of lawyers, activists, and other judges at lower levels across the country to really lean into this argument. And you can look at cases all over the country, and you can see that they are slowing down. They are taking longer. They're not getting dismissed as quickly. And that creates all sorts of pain and difficulties, especially for local and independent journalists who now have much kind of higher odds of being dragged through expensive litigation.
So you talk about, let's look at some of the cases that President Trump is involved with right now. He sues ABC. He sues the Des Moines Register. He sues CBS. Is he trying to bring these cases to the Supreme Court? Now, of course, ABC, there was a settlement. To explain what these cases were about and what it means to settle.
Yeah, well, first of all, Trump is very much trying to get a case to the Supreme Court that will lead to the overturning of Sullivan. I don't think any of those three cases you mentioned are the likely vehicles, but there are a bunch of others working their way through the federal appeal system that I think stand a much better chance. These more recent lawsuits against ABC, CBS, and the Des Moines Register are all pretty clearly efforts by Trump and his allies to weaponize the law to kind of punish criticism and to deter others from speaking up and saying critical things. And they involve different legal theories. The ABC case was a straight-up defamation case. The Des Moines Register and the...
I mean, ABC case where George Stephanopoulos had said President Trump was found civilly liable for rape. Now, again, the judge in the case said, in common parlance, this case would be about rape.
Yeah, and even in the technical detail is that he was actually found liable by the jury for sexual abuse, not rape. So even if you assume for argument's sake that that's an important difference and that Stephanopoulos got it wrong, and I think Stephanopoulos would say he did not get it wrong, but for argument's sake, let's say he did get it wrong. That is exactly the type of mistake that is supposed to be protected by New York Times versus Sullivan, because it is an honest, good faith error, and you should not be held liable. ABC nonetheless decided that it was prudent to settle this case.
Or Disney did. ABC.
Disney's parent company did. And I mean, I think the rationale for that, and we're seeing this play out in other settings as well, is that these big multinational companies that have varied interests are trying to protect their corporate interests and do not feel like having outstanding litigation against the president of the United States is in their best interests. And so they are pretty clearly, I think, taking the side of their profits in the long term over the First Amendment concerns that many of their journalists have. And so, and you're seeing this a very similar dynamic playing out with CBS right now.
And CBS is the case of 60 Minutes, and Trump is suing them for $20 billion, I think, at this point, for how they edited a Kamala Harris piece.
Yeah, and this is the very definition of what I think is a meritless lawsuit. I mean, at the time the lawsuit was filed, there were some discrepancies in the way CBS kind of cut or aired parts of Kamala Harris's interview with 60 Minutes. We now have the full unedited transcript. We have the full unedited recordings of those interviews. And it is plainly clear, objectively, that the interview, while edited, was not done so deceptively. There are not material differences between the different things that aired on different CBS shows. And so the lawsuit clearly, to me at least, and certainly all of the legal observers I've spoken to, with the exception of people aligned with Trump, is not a strong legal argument. And yet, CBS's parent company, which has a multi-billion dollar merger pending that it needs federal approval for, has started talking with the Trump side about possibly settling this. And the rationale, again, is quite clear. They are concerned on the Paramount side that if they do not settle this, that the Trump administration is going to essentially punish them by holding up this multi-billion dollar merger. And so you have journalists and I think media executives at CBS who are apoplectic about the prospect of settling this because, A, they are on very strong legal footing, and B, it would set a terrible precedent that the companies are going to cave to this kind of legal extortion. But I think we'll see what happens.
How does protection of the press in the United States compare to other countries? And talk about libel tourism.
Yeah. So the U.S. is, and the First Amendment is a really special thing in the U.S. It's one of the things that distinguishes America from many other democracies. So if you look at countries like the U.K., for example, or Australia, which are, you know, very small-d democratic countries, it is much harder for journalists and others to write critical things or to investigate powerful people in institutions in those countries because their libel laws make it much easier to sue. And that also allows you to much more easily and kind of potently threaten people. And so you have in the UK, for example, we've had this phenomenon, as you just said, called libel tourism, where people, rich people like Russian oligarchs and big companies file lawsuits against journalists from all over the world in the British court system. And that has created a real chilling effect, even for American journalists who sometimes find themselves getting sued in British courts just because you publish something, it goes online, it's accessible probably everywhere in the world, that can expose you to liability in the British court system. Now, it's getting a little bit harder to actually bring those suits right now, but to me, it's a really clear reminder of the importance of the protections we have in the U.S. It really does differentiate this country from many others. And it means we have a much more robust and aggressive media. And it also means that just normal people who want to circulate a petition online can do so without fear that if they get a fact wrong, they are not going to be bullied and intimidated and potentially sued because of just minor inaccuracies.
So finally, after you wrote this book, Murder the Truth, Fear the First Amendment, a secret campaign to protect the powerful, were you more or less hopeful?
Oh, my goodness, less hopeful. We have a real problem right now in this country. We have very strong legal protections, and yet people and companies and institutions are on a daily basis threatening journalists and threatening normal people, and they are getting their way a lot of the time. And that's it with our legal protections in place. And the assault on these protections is very much underway. It's a very much a live threat, I think. And we're seeing the White House engage in this almost on a daily basis, it seems. So I think the threat is growing, and it has huge implications for our democracy and the ability of everyone to speak their mind and criticize powerful people.
We're going to talk about some of the particular cases you look at in the book after the show, and we'll post it as web exclusive at democracynow.org. David Enrich, New York Times Business Investigations editor, his new book just out, Murder the Truth, Fear the First Amendment, and a Secret Campaign to Protect the Powerful. Coming up, we speak with an immigration attorney representing an LGBTQ Venezuelan asylum seeker flown from the U.S. to El Salvador, where he's being jailed at a supermax prison after Trump invoked the Alien Enemies Act of 1798. Stay with us.
Se quedan mudos, otros tienen memoria. memoria para olvidar.
Never Again by La Santa Cecilia. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. A legal battle is continuing between the Trump administration and federal judge over the president's invocation of the 1798 Alien Enemies Act to expel over 130 Venezuelan immigrants from the United States to a maximum security prison in El Salvador. CBS reports new court filings suggest the administration may invoke its state secrets privilege to block requests from D.C. District Chief Judge James Boasberg for more information about what happened Saturday when the Trump administration ignored the judge's order to turn around three flights headed to El Salvador. It's not clear if one of the flights had even left the tarmac. The Trump administration claims all the men sent under the Alien Enemies Act were members of a Venezuelan gang, but a growing number of press accounts cast doubt on Trump's claims. We're joined here in New York by Margaret Cargioli, directing attorney of policy and advocacy at Immigrant Defenders Law Center, which is representing an LGBTQ Venezuelan asylum seeker who has flown to El Salvador, even though he did not have a deportation order. We're also joined in Washington, D.C. by Juan Papier, America's deputy director at Human Rights Watch. He's investigated the prison system in El Salvador. Margaret Cargioli, let's begin with you. Tell us about the person who was sent to the maximum security prison in El Salvador.
Our client is an asylum seeker who entered the United States via the U.S. southern border through the CBP One app over a year ago. He was detained in Southern California, was waiting for his right to have, you know, a judge hear his case as to asylum. He was flagged because he has tattoos. He's in the arts field. Solely because he has tattoos, the only evidence that the government at that point had submitted were pictures of what they attribute Tren de Agua, Aragua gang members to have, just one page of a few tattoos. And solely because of that, having no criminal record, he has been sent to a very dangerous place where we fear for his safety.
You don't want to use his name. Why?
We are seriously concerned for his well-being, his safety, and he is an asylum seeker. He fled Venezuela because of persecution, and so we have to keep some of the details of his case private, and it's extremely concerning that the United States government is not sharing any information. We did not know his whereabouts from Friday until Monday when he had an immigration court hearing. At that hearing, it was the first time that the United States government actually confirmed that he was sent to El Salvador.
Now, just to understand, he was deported? Would you use that term, deported, even though there was no order of deportation?
There was no order of deportation. There was no order of removal. He was not deported. He was sent there unlawfully. He still has a pending immigration court hearing that's coming up very soon, and he has a right to seek asylum. What happened here is extremely unusual and concerning.
So my question is, why was he sent to, among many other questions, El Salvador? Juan Papier, if you can talk from your Human Rights Watch perspective about this prison, this supermax prison, CICAT, in San Salvador, that these prisoners have been sent to, and the deal the Trump administration has made with their ally, the president of El Salvador, with Bukele.
Amy, thank you for having me. The CICOT, the Center for Confinement of Terrorists in El Salvador, is a mega prison. inaugurated in 2023. It was initially announced for 20,000 detainees, and the president then doubled the capacity to 40,000 detainees. It has 256 cells where detainees are expected to share a bed. The access to the media and to human rights organizations such as Human Rights Watch is severely restricted. And the government has publicly said that people who are sent to the CICOT will never be allowed out. We have not been able to identify any detainees who have left CICOT, but we have every reason to believe that people held there are subject to the similar treatment as in other prisons in El Salvador. That is, torture, deaths in prison, and enforced disappearances. People in CICOT are completely cut off from the rest of the world and denied any legal, any meaningful access to legal recourse. This is an effort to create a Guantanamo on steroids, to put these people outside of the protections of the law, both in the United States and in El Salvador.
So let's talk about, in 2023, the U.S. State Department report noted El Salvador had harsh and life-threatening prison conditions. Can you talk about your thoughts as the Trump administration has agreed to pay the government of President Nayib Bukele $6 million for a year of services to accept people removed forcefully from the United States? As this lawyer, Margaret Cargioli, is describing, disappeared from the United States.
This is an open violation of the United States obligations under international law because they are sending people to a place where they have serious risk of being tortured and subject to human rights violations, in addition to the violations by denying them the possibility of seeking asylum in the United States. We have documented in prisons in El Salvador cases of torture, of enforced disappearances, conditions in detention that are dismal, and massive arbitrary arrest of people who have nothing to do with the gangs in El Salvador who are being held in these prisons as well. These are dismal conditions in these prisons, and I am very worried about the safety of these migrants who have been sent there. It's worth noting that the governments of the United States and El Salvador have not released a list of people sent there, nor any indications that they effectively are part of the Venezuelan gang known as Tren de Aragua.
Something like 261 people died in El Salvador's prisons. Can you talk about just last year? Can you talk about what you know about the torture, the lack of medical attention, the abuse that occurs not only at CICOT, but in these other prisons that the U.S. has now made a deal with the president of Salvador to house U.S. prisoners?
Local human rights groups in El Salvador have recorded 350 cases of detainees who've died in prisons since March 2022, when a state of emergency began in El Salvador. The country has been under this state of emergency for 3 years now. That means that constitutional due process rights are suspended. And we at Human Rights Watch have documented many of the cases of people who died in prison, and we have identified evidence of state responsibility of some of these deaths. We have reviewed these cases with forensic experts and identified evidence of possible torture leading to some of these violations. These are the conditions where these people are being held. There are, as the State Department held in its 2023 report on human rights, life-threatening. So I think it's very shameful to see Secretary of State Rubio say that these are very good prisons. These are prisons with life-threatening conditions.
So, Margaret Cargioli, have you talked to your client?
We have not been able to speak to our client. We did reach out to the Department of Homeland Security, and yesterday we're told that they cannot facilitate communication with our client because he's been removed. We are hoping that with public pressure and through federal litigation, we are able to soon talk to our client, find out information as to exactly where he is, you know, what conditions he's being held under, and also to find out exactly what transpired. How is it that an asylum seeker detained in the United States with an immigration attorney disappears for several days and ends up in a maximum security prison in a third country?
can federal Judge Boasberg, who is hearing, trying to get answers from the U.S. government, Pam Bondi, the attorney general, says they don't have to respond with specific answers about how these deportations have happened. Can he play a role in getting your client back?
Yes, our client actually is does fit under the class within that lawsuit. So we're hoping that through the litigation, we will be able to have our client return to the United States. The United States government has to comply with the law. They have to comply with federal court law rulings. And we know that the judge is reviewing the case as to whether the government is in contempt of court for not complying with its rulings and information that it sought.
Well, we'll continue to follow this case. Margaret Cargioli is directing Attorney of Policy and Advocacy at Immigrant Defenders Law Center, speaking to us here in New York. And Juan Papier, America's Deputy Director at Human Rights Watch, speaking to us from Washington, D.C. That does it for our show. Happy birthday to Tammy Warrenoff. To see all transcripts, podcasts, video and audio podcasts, you can go to democracynow.org and also sign up there for our daily newsletter. Amy Goodman, thanks for joining us.
Wolf Island and Kingston Massive, Saturday.